from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Okay, this time it's personal, painful. In my own backyard, Boston, an all-time record snowfall in the last month. 6 feet plus. Blizzard after blizzard. Cities shut down, gummed up for days. But I can still see over the snowdrifts, and it's not just here. Extreme weather events have intensified all over. Scientists say this is climate change. Now, business economists are saying, look at the mind-boggling costs of this. This hour on Point, the cost of extreme weather. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Has it hit you, your region, your pocketbook, the public budget, drought, hurricane, deluge, blizzard? If this is the new path we're on, what does it mean for our economy? It's been snow, it's been rain, it's been wind, it's been drought and dry in Boston in the last month. Well, here was reporter Jim Cantore of the Weather Channel on Tuesday, standing on top of a pile of snow close to one story high.
Ooh, it's crazy, man. The first 9 days of February have featured over 40 inches of snow here in Boston. We are on an exponential rise here in snow totals. We are now number 9 for the season, and we have had, you know, just yesterday, hey, we had a top 5 snowstorm. Here's the deal. More snow to come. Piles like this all over the city of Boston.
It hits everybody, the full economy, right down to here's Kathy, who works in a grocery store in Boston, talked with my station, WBUR, earlier this week. Said a lot of her co-workers could not make it in because of the snow that hits the paycheck.
Yeah, like a few of them, they didn't come today, so I know they don't get paid. They already have like 3 days out of the paycheck, so it's going to be tough for them at the end of the month to meet the bills for next month because most people are living on a weekly paycheck.
It hits the hourly wage. It hits everybody when, in Boston's case, public transportation actually went down under the weight of snow and age and deferred maintenance. Nobody wants to pay for all of this. The MBTA general manager, who has now submitted her resignation, kind of just let loose under the pressure of working with infrastructure in the face of extreme weather.
For anyone to have any belief that a system that's over 100 years old, that's got equipment, much of it that is running out there on this red and this orange lines that are at much over capacity, can continue with the age that it is, and to think that it's going to have the resilience to wind up rebounding and flying like an eagle, that is absolutely the epitome of, and I'm not going to say foolish. So this was a perfect storm.
You could say that about a lot of infrastructure in the United States of America. Of course, Hurricane Sandy showed people all over south of Boston. Here was in Seabright, New Jersey, Bain's Hardware, one of the businesses hit there. Here, Pat Bain, one of the co-owners, just one business, one piece of the economy, describing the work it took to recover from Sandy.
The entire store had 4.5 foot of water, and it's been 6 weeks of work, and we finally got this up and going with help of many, many people.
And that's just one little piece of a great big economy. With me first today from Washington is Frank Nutter, president of the Reinsurance Association of America, the national group that insures insurance companies. They are seeing the bottom line consequences of extreme weather. Frank Nutter, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
You must be exquisitely attuned to the cost of these extreme weather events. How's it showing up, Frank?
Well, it really has been a pattern for some time. If you think back to even Hurricane Andrew in the early 90s, followed by a series of major events in Florida in the 2004-2005 period, reinsurers and insurance companies have seen the impact, the bottom line, if you will, for really quite some time. And surprisingly, 2014 was actually a low catastrophe loss year of about $15 billion in the United States. But the average over the last 10 years has really been considerably higher, almost twice that. So we're seeing an increasing number of these major events at increasing costs.
What is the path we're on for economic impact? If we stay on that trend line, and scientists say that climate change means extreme weather, means the trend line goes up, what do the consequences of that look like from your seat, Frank?
Well, you're seeing the kinds of events that in Boston, and you have my my sympathy for your situation in Boston in particular. But if you look back to Superstorm Sandy in 2012, a similar kind of major wind and precipitation event, which is increasingly common in a climate-changed world. So while I could not predict next year or the year after in Boston or any other part of the country, the reality is the science community is saying that we're going to see an increasing number of these heavy precipitation events, whether it's rain or snow. And the bottom line for insurance companies is that they pay a lot of claims related to all of this. But more importantly, the economy suffers at nearly twice of what the insured losses are. And then public taxpayers pay through disaster assistance for much of the recovery for infrastructure as well as people's properties.
I mean, I've been struck, as Boston has had this just unbelievable deluge of snow in this case, how, you know, you throw the infrastructure off a little bit and things just grind to a halt. I mean, the roads closed, the trains go down, people can't even get to work. And this is just one corner of the country. You look at the maps of fire and drought in the West. Look at the agricultural impacts in the Midwest. Look at the flooding along the eastern seaboard. If we stay in an upward trend here, does this begin to knock points off of GDP? Does this bite right into the nation's core economic health?
Well, a good question about core economic health. It certainly has the kind of interim impact, business interruption, and as was suggested by one of the commentators that you cited earlier, just people getting to work and getting paid to go to work. Sometimes with these events, you see this surge of economic activity after the event.
Yeah.
Through disaster assistance payments from the government or
rebuild.
Insurance payments to people rebuilding. So I can't honestly say, and I have no reason to think, that it would have a detrimental impact long term on GDP, but it certainly is a, I hate to use the phrase new normal, because I don't want to suggest you're going to see these kinds of storms every year, but these kinds of storms are happening more frequently across the country.
We've got business groups now getting very focused on the cost of this. There's one called the Risky Business Project. It's got Hank Paulson, who was Treasury Secretary under George W. Bush. Big businessman and former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg is in here. Tom Steyer, financier and environmentalist, is in here. They've got a big new report that's come out from independent folks saying within the next 15 years, higher sea levels, storm surges, hurricanes, raising the annual price tag for coastal damage just along the east coast of Gulf of Mexico to $35 billion. Midwestern, southern agricultural areas could see declines in yields of more than 10% over the next 5 to 25 years because of increased drought and flooding, they say, unless farmers adapt their crops. Of course, there will be adaptation. One of the people who's associated with Risky Business is the executive chairman of Cargill, the huge agricultural company, Gregory Page. He's working on it. And here's what he has to say about American business thinking about extreme weather.
So I think this behavior that goes on today to react to changes year to year in the weather situation and the climate they confront, applied to a longer time horizon, is exactly what Risky Business is trying to have happen. Let's have those discussions, what if?
Frank Nutter, please stand by in Washington. Also with us right now from Washington is Lori Johnson. She's chief economist at the Climate Center of the National Resources Defense Council. Lori Johnson, thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be here.
What does the accounting, what bottom line look like on extreme weather and our economy? Are we prepared with infrastructure, with business resilience? Can we be prepared for what's coming at us in this century?
Well, I think we're only starting to see some of these impacts. And you asked a question earlier about long-term growth, and this is something that is sort of near and dear to economists' hearts. We think a lot about productivity. And when you have an event like you've had and are having in Boston, immediately you have these effects, which are our losses. But if you think about this occurring over and over again over time, you're basically stopping for a period of time while you're under the snow, so to speak, and then you start up again. But when you start up again, you're repairing things. So the money that you spend that you're repairing things with could have been spent on alternative things that grow the economy. So really, how many steps forward are you moving forward, and then how many back? This can really compound over time.
I mean, Frank suggests that perhaps it doesn't really hit the bottom line on GDP, because you've got destruction and then rebuilding, destruction, rebuilding. And it's all economic activity, so fine.
Right. that you do have these short-term impacts of repairing. But again, that's just going back to where you were. Think about perhaps you're going to school and you're continually getting interrupted in your education for one reason or another. You keep getting put back by several years. Over the long term, that's going to affect your productivity and how much you make in the future.
I mean, of course it would. I guess what does that mean? You're just losing industrial capacity because it gets knocked back, knocked down by big weather?
Yeah, effectively, you're using up some of your capital stock, right? We build our infrastructure and our roads, and they are very, very important for our economic productivity. And when those things get damaged, you are affecting the productivity.
When you see somebody like the head of Cargill, big agricultural ag industry company, saying, hey, we've got to pay attention to this, does it hearten you? Do we need American business to do what? To be investing in resilience or working on the bigger problem of climate change itself?
Actually, the Cargill example is very interesting because in Texas, they've closed down one of their working plants and literally people are out of work. It's not just sort of this whole picture of what we do in the future, but what's happening right now to people.
Closed down why? Because of weather?
Because of drought. They can't run their agricultural operations. So literally, there are towns that are effectively economically closing down. But for long-term adaptation, to go to your point, Tom, we have to start making plans to adapt to what's coming. We know more is coming, and we will need to do that. And actually, the president has put forth a very comprehensive budget where he is really taking on this issue where we need to actually prepare cities to start thinking about how they're going to build things.
Laurie Johnson, hold the thought. We're up against a break. Frank Nutter, we're looking at the high economic cost of the age of extreme weather. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about the high economic cost of the age of extreme weather. People taking precautions, people trying to get set up for a century where this may be much more common. Tuesday, at the Goldman Sachs Technology and Internet Conference, the CEO of Apple, Tim Cook, said that Apple recognizes climate change as a problem, committed to reducing its own climate impact, but also to assuring its power supply in this century. He's outlining steps that Apple's taking and saying they're going to have their own practically solar farm. Huge.
We know in Apple that climate change is real. Our view is that the time for talk has passed and the time for action is now. And we've shown that with what we've done. We're now running all of our data centers, which require lots of energy for those of you that understand data centers. All of them are run off renewable energy. And just today, we're announcing our biggest, boldest, and most ambitious project ever. We are partnering with First Solar to build a solar farm in Monterey County.
A huge solar farm, $850 million project that will power all of Apple's operations in California. Of course, they can afford it. They're sitting on $142 billion in cash. Not everyone is. Victor in Buffalo, New York. Victor, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
My pleasure, and good to have you back, Tom.
Thank you.
Well, I live in the south towns of the city itself, and in a 72-hour period in November this last year, we had in excess of 87 inches of snowfall where I reside. It closed the southern area, it closed Route 90. We saw tremendous impact. I mean, just personally, I lost a week's pay, unable to leave my home. The place where my mother was employed, the roof actually collapsed. We had dozens of buildings in the area, roof collapses, businesses, elderly care homes. And even personally, we are snowmobilers ourselves. We saw damage to our machines volunteering with the local fire departments to evacuate stranded motorists. It was just an incredible period. And since then, we've seen more than 4 feet of snowfall happen after all of that snowfall melted. And we're still seeing our roads getting tighter and tighter because of the snow buildup. And it keeps coming. We're looking at record cold temperatures approaching for this weekend. They say first time this cold in multiple decades.
Victor, how do you see the future? I mean, Buffalo, as I well know, is no stranger to snow. I've seen tall, tall snow in Buffalo for a long time. do you see this becoming more routine, more regular? Is there some reason that it's tougher to deal with now than it was 20 years ago, 40 years ago?
Well, we kind of take that pride in dealing with the storms, but there's that certain level of realization that we can't deal with those kinds of storms on our own. I mean, who pays for the losses that are involved? Who shows up to dig us out? I mean, that's not something that we're capable of doing. I have family in the area of Cambridge and Winthrop, Massachusetts. I've been seeing their photos coming through, people digging out repeatedly every day, a couple times a day, dealing with the snow that falls. That takes a toll, and the question is, where does it come from? At this point, we just take it as it comes. There's no other choice. So what happens when I can't go to work for a week? Now I have to have a plan in place to deal with that?
Victor, I so appreciate your call. Lori Johnson, people have dealt with rough weather throughout all of history. Is there something in the rhythm of, you know, being hit by it, recovering and moving on, that is now being disrupted or aggravated in a way that's going to put us in a significantly tougher spot?
I can't tell if I'm actually on because there might be a technology problem, but I'll try to answer your question.
Okay.
So I think, yes, it is different, right? What we're seeing is a relentless repetition of these extreme events. And they're record events, right? So we're having record events everywhere across the world of all different types, as you have highlighted, Tom. And once that starts happening, they're not records anymore. They're pretty much becoming a norm. So we have to prepare for that. I'm really glad that you had the Apple executive on here.
Tim
because,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I think if you want to think about the economics of this, it is, yes, it is depressing that there are these costs, but we actually can think about solutions that are very cost effective, especially when you count all of these costs. And really what we're doing is, you know, it's just terrible economics. We have alternative energy that is getting more and more competitive. It's cleaner. It doesn't cause all kinds of damages to people. That burning fossil fuels does. And so it's really, you know, the way that we are running our energy economy is reckless, and it's really morally indefensible because we can do better, and we have all these tools available to us.
Of course, not everybody can afford to do what Apple's doing. Frank Nutter, here's Tim Cook again, CEO of Apple. They're just going to dip into that $140 billion-plus pile of cash they've got and build almost $1 billion solar farm, enough to do what? Well, here he is describing what it will do for Apple.
It's enough to provide renewable energy for all of our new campus that you and I were just speaking of a few minutes ago, Apple Campus 2, every other office we have in California, all 52 retail stores we have in California, and our data center in Newark.
Frank Nutter, that's a pretty incredible investment in solar energy. I guess that will secure Apple's energy supply and make it cleaner, but how many businesses can afford to do something on that scale, Frank?
Well, I'm sure that most can't, of course. And yet there are other options for rebuilding. I said earlier about the economic activity that comes post-event through mm-hmm. insurance payments and disaster assistance. There's your opportunity in these communities to look at where things are built and how things are built, particularly public infrastructure, which clearly impacts most people's lives more broadly in an area than just the immediate home or business that they're in. Given that the government expends an extraordinary amount of money post-event, Sandy was $60 billion, disaster assistance in 2 or 3 years ago was $89 billion, conditions really should be put on that to the extent that it's spent on public infrastructure, whether it's roads or public transportation or the grid, the grid as a way to rebuild smarter, as well as in the context of looking at how to move our energy supply toward alternative energy sources.
Lori, how does this balance out? We got Mark writing to us here. He says online, says it really is a horrible cycle. The more federal, state, and local governments have to spend to keep their infrastructure clear and in decent repair, the less they can afford to spend on other items, programs that people need or want. If extreme weather starts biting in, claiming a cost with these big events, does that cycle out? Does that even out over time because you get economic activity cleaning up? Or does it gradually grind down our infrastructure, our capacity to have top-flight infrastructure?
So we really have two problems here, right? One is actually rebuilding and dealing with the impacts, and the other is transitioning to a cleaner energy system. Now, I know it costs some areas money to do cleaner energy, but it is also becoming more competitive and cheaper in some areas. Having said that, I have a hard time actually believing that this will be that hard. Just, what was it, a few months ago, we put a spacecraft, we slingshot a spacecraft that traveled hundreds of millions of miles around the solar system four times, and it caught up and landed on a comet that was going 24,000 miles per hour.
Laura, I have no idea why you're going to that. We're talking about roads. But seriously,
you're talking about
spacecraft. I'm talking about roads that will get people to work or rails that will get people to work. Forget spacecraft. How do you just have a way to make an economy function when you get extreme weather events that come in and tear your infrastructure apart?
We have to make these investments and we have to spend the tax dollars on cleaning up these impacts. My point really was just to say that we can do the clean technology component. I'm not pessimistic about. Yes, I agree with you that these costs are real and government's going to have to figure out a way to make these investments and do smarter planning in the future.
Of course, it's not just government. David in Harlan, Iowa. David, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Excellent show.
Thank you.
Just wanted to mention that I'm a fifth generation farmer here. I'm in my 30s. And growing up on the farm here, became certified organic in 83, and the choices we made on our farm were generally around soil health, building up the soil, and doing the right thing, keeping livestock on the land.
Mm-hmm.
But now we've had to adapt over the years and add climate change in our decision-making, and that includes diversifying our crop rotation, having small grains along with corn and soybeans. But this monoculture that we see across the Midwest and elsewhere of corn and soybeans specifically, you know, the thought of climate change, you know, you could lose your entire crop and then you're done. So what we do here is having, you know, 7-year rotation where we have oats, rye, barley, we have hay, we have corn and beans and cattle and hogs as well.
Yep.
So that adaptation has been a part of our farm for years now. But like I said, it's climate change that's now factoring in.
Of course, that sounds like the kind of range of crops folks had on the farm when I was growing up in a similar circumstance, David. Then everybody got very monoculture. But I wonder what you see coming. I mean, I'm reading this Risky Business Project report. This is out a bunch of business leaders here, including the head of Cargill, a name I'm sure you know. Their report says, as extreme heat spreads across the middle of the country, they're talking about the United States, by the end of the century, some states in the Southeast, lower Great Plains, and Midwest, where you are, risk up to a 50 to 70% loss in average annual crop yields. Corn, soy, cotton, wheat. Absent adaptation, of course, people will try and adapt. But listen to just the temperature that they're projecting here, David. They say by the middle of this century, the average American will likely see 27 to 50 days over 95 degrees each year, 2 to more than 3 times the average number over 95 we've seen over the past 30 years. By the end of this century, that number will likely reach 45 to 96 days over 95 degrees each year on average. They say that's just a straight-up threat to human health outside working on the farm, David, whether it's organic or not.
Sure. That's where we got to do the best we can with the resources we have, I guess. And we have to adapt. We can't keep turning a blind eye to the reality here. You know, people that argue against climate change, you know, we live it every day. Just last week we had temperature got down to -8, and then the next day it was up in the 50s. And that's, you know, it's hard on livestock. But hearing my dad talk historically, he's been telling me the last few years how he's never seen the unknown of weather the way we're seeing it now.
David, I wish you very good luck and hope that fifth generation goes into a sixth and a seventh there in Harlan, Iowa. We're talking about the high economic cost of extreme weather. With me right now from St. Petersburg, Florida, is R.J. Lehman, senior fellow, editor-in-chief, co-founder of the R Street Institute. Interesting think tank, promotes free markets and limited government, broke off from the Heartland Institute in a disagreement over climate change. They're very focused on the cost of this. R.J. Lehman, great to have you with us. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So how are you looking at the future economic impacts of extreme weather.
So as you mentioned, yeah, we did break off from Heartland. We had some disagreements in their approach to some of these issues.
I mean, these are the guys who were so into global warming denial, they put up a billboard of Ted Kaczynski, and they wanted to put up Charles Manson and Fidel Castro and Osama bin Laden as the face of climate change believers. You guys broke off. What do you see?
Yeah, that was the precipitating event for us breaking off.
Yes.
We accept the scientific consensus. We're not climate scientists ourselves. We're public policy experts. And our position is that rather than deny that this is occurring, we should look for market-oriented solutions to deal with it. So some of the things that include are, first, getting the federal government out of the business of subsidizing development in particularly at-risk areas.
What do you mean by that?
So there is, for instance, the National Flood Insurance Program, which for many of its customers do not pay risk-based rates. They pay less than the risk that they face.
So if you want to build it, have a nice house on the beach, face that risk on your own hook, you're saying?
Correct. That's why the program is currently about $25 billion in debt to the federal treasury. There are similar issues with the crop insurance program. You had a farmer call. I mean, a big issue in crop insurance subsidies and crop and agriculture subsidies generally are that they encourage conversion of sod of prairie and wetlands into farmland, and those are easily erodible areas that they probably shouldn't be used for that purpose. There's any number of subsidies that a law that was actually sponsored back in the 80s by Senator John Chafee from Rhode Island, created what's called the Coastal Barrier Resources Act. It sets aside a segment of the coast along the Gulf Coast, East Coast, and around the Great Lakes where new land cannot receive federal subsidies.
You're in favor of that because what? You think moving into that land makes us more susceptible to climate change, extreme weather, developing that land?
Right. I mean, so part of the problem, we are certainly seeing an increase in catastrophes. I mean, if you look at the global level, over the last 30 years, some data I have from Munich Re, over the last 30 years, we've averaged about 640 a year. Over the last 10 years, it's been 830 a year. In 2013, it was 920. In 2014, it was 980. So it's not your imagination. These are becoming more common. Part of that is probably due to climate change. But another part of it is simply that we've been developing in riskier areas. We have more people living in flood zones. We have more people living in areas that are affected by drought and wildfire. And we don't believe government policy should encourage that. We are market-oriented people. We believe you buy a property, you have the right to develop it as you see fit. But you should – a place where market-oriented folks and environmentally conscious folks can come together is that, at the very least, stop the federal subsidies.
That would make folks wake up and smell the coffee, certainly, if the risk is really all on their hook, all – in their lap. R.J. Lehman at the R Street Institute, please stand by in St. Petersburg. Frank Nutter with the Reinsurance Association of America in Washington, and Lori Johnson with the NRDC. We're talking about the high economic cost of the age of extreme weather. Listeners, what do you see in that cost? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
In Austin, Texas, a community is designed to be more neighborly.
Every house has a garage, but they're always in the back. The porch is in the front.
Can the way a place is built get people to connect?
We have made an incredible number of friends.
And can it make them healthier? The City's Project, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for On Point comes from GEICO, offering a variety of insurance products, including auto, renters, boat, and motorcycle. More at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO. And Gentle Giant Moving Company, orchestrating moves around the block or around the globe for 35 years, with locations throughout New England and across the country, offering moving, packing, and storage services. Learn more at gentlegiant.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the high economic cost of the age of extreme weather, droughts, blizzards, hurricanes, downpours, and the very real costs we are just beginning to acknowledge, to live with. Certainly in Boston in the last month, a record amount of snow in a very, very condensed period of time, more than 6 feet in 30 days. That's an all-time record. And it hits people. It hits individuals. It hits businesses. Here's a housekeeper in my backyard, Maria Souza, telling WBUR she won't get paid for the day she's missed because of the snow.
It's my first day I come today. Yesterday I can't because my street is not clean. It's a very end. So when I come to work, I have to fly. I can't fly. I have to stay home. You want to stay safe. If you not come, you have to use your sick time or vacation. What are you going to do? I have to survive.
Can't fly to work, though. What should we do about it? Hot disagreements about that. Here was John Boehner, House Speaker John Boehner. After the House approved the bill that would extend the Keystone Pipeline, they sent it to President Obama. President Obama has said he'll veto it. John Boehner saying, the president's just allied with a bunch of left-wing nuts and anarchists. Anarchists.
The president's standing with a bunch of left-fringe extremists and anarchists. The president needs to listen to the American people and say, yes, let's build the Keystone Pipeline.
Okay, maybe that'll set us up just right for the future. I don't know. Rob writes to us on Twitter, we need a two-prong attack. Address CO2 emissions now and improve infrastructure. The time is now. Frank Nutter, do we have the resources as a nation to take this on, build up, harden our infrastructure to make it more resilient so the economy can work through what we apparently are facing in this century and keep on chugging?
Well, Tom, the political system is accustomed to going in after an event and writing checks, pretty extraordinary checks. If we can do that, then we can think about these communities, the public infrastructure, and frankly, businesses, and find ways in advance to provide incentives for adaptation. I thought David from Iowa was really right on point about the value of recognizing that even if you have a debate or a dispute about whether or not we have, quote, global warming, we certainly have the impacts of extreme weather events that are clear, increasingly clear in our communities and obviously in the farming areas. And rather than spending the money after the fact, why not spend it in advance and really prepare?
RJ, if we just sit the same old way and wait for all this to hit, how do you see the impact economically?
The impact may be very significant, even in ways that we aren't necessarily thinking about today. To give an example, back in 2010, Russia suffered a severe heat wave. They had about $15 billion in crop losses, particularly in the wheat area. The result of that was that Russia imposed export restrictions on wheat, and that interfered with the entire supply chain of wheat globally, raised the price, it led to wheat shortages. A lot of this sort of severe weather has other impacts. Floods and drought and wildfire can all be correlated with civil unrest, with political instability. These are serious concerns down the road in a lot of areas of the world. We have to be concerned about the United States as well, and there are certainly impacts in the United States, but much of the brunt of climate change would probably hit some areas that are already fairly unstable.
Are you talking within the United States or beyond?
Beyond. We certainly will. I'm in Florida, and we have to look at the rising sea levels because if you look at the long-term map, they're not favorable in places like Louisiana as well. But we have a global economy and global supply chains are essential to the flourishing of that economy. And so we will feel the impact here of things that happen in, say, Indonesia or India.
We're looking at Coca-Cola. Many parts of the world, they can't find water to make Coke with. Nike, really worried about its supply chain and talking very loudly about it. real businesses, and then just simple, like, go out and work, build a house, whatever it's going to be. Back in the 1970s, there was all kinds of hand-wringing over America's productivity slowdown because productivity declined 1.5%. Now, from this risky business project, again, of business people looking out at extreme weather and climate change in this century, they are, with those maybe doubling or tripling of the number of days per year over 95 degrees, they're writing labor productivity of outdoor workers, such as those working in construction, utility maintenance, landscaping, agriculture, could be reduced by as much as 3% by the end of the century. Double what got everybody worried in the 1970s. They say over the long term, during portions of the year, extreme heat could surpass the threshold at which the human body can no longer maintain a normal core temperature. That makes an awful lot of work outdoors pretty tough. Yukon, Oklahoma, Josh is calling. Hi, Josh. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I work in the energy sector, and it's kind of ironic we're talking about this. Here in Oklahoma, we're entering our fifth year of drought. In the energy sector, we're using fresh water from farmlands to frack. It's getting diverted from different lands, sometimes up to 3 or 4 miles away. It's a huge waste. And with this drought, we're also seeing a huge fight between the state of Oklahoma and the state of Texas, as well as the state of Oklahoma against a Native American tribe in southeast Oklahoma about diverting water from hundreds of miles away, maybe 120 miles away, to the Oklahoma City area so residents can have water because we're in such a drought here in the central state of Oklahoma.
Josh, you raise a really interesting issue right there, and I'm glad you call with it. Thank you very much. Lori Johnson, what about this? I mean, here Josh is describing kind of resource wars between regions, between economic sectors, even within a region.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most concerning aspects of climate change is the scarcity issue. The U.S. military, for a reason, calls climate change a threat multiplier, which means when you have already conflicts over resources, if you have further impacts on those, you're going to accelerate those conflicts. Water is a pretty interesting issue, though, especially with energy, because we use a lot of energy. We use a lot of water in our fossil fuel energy system. So not only do we have these the scarcity of water becoming a problem, we are ironically relying on water to fuel the very energy system that is creating the problem.
Of course, sometimes it's not the scarcity of water that Josh is looking at there in Oklahoma. Sometimes it's too much. I've got here Kevin Turnberth, the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, is talking about how storms with higher ocean temperatures, there's more humidity in the atmosphere, more moisture in the atmosphere. That ups the intensity of storms and the precipitation. Some places too little, some places too much. That can be equally disruptive. Meg in Montello, Wisconsin. Meg, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to comment. We had what was called a 100-year flood that went through our town. And what the major impact was that the bridge that basically divides our town in half was compromised during the flood. Mm-hmm. And so even after the waters receded, we still were not able to get from one side of the town to the other. And it was about a 45-minute drive around from one side to the other if you tried to get around this waterway. And it really impacted people. My sons, for example, were in high school at the time and had a part-time job at a factory on the other side.
Yep.
And normally walked or rode their bikes. Well, all of a sudden they couldn't get to their work. And, they didn't have driver's licenses at the time.
Yep.
And there were other people in town as well that, walked to work, didn't have a vehicle to get there, had no way to get to their jobs on the other side, or even our grocery store that was on the other side of town.
And that's what you call very direct disruption of the economy. Meg, I really appreciate your call. RJ, help us think about this. I mean, Meg's in Montello, Wisconsin, not so big. Here you've got a city like Boston where its whole transit system, public transit, came to a halt for a full day. The city says it can't afford to update its mass transit. I mean, if you multiply this by cities and towns across the country, in a time of extreme weather? Do we get to a place where we just can't afford to keep up with the degradation, the erosion of infrastructure, RJ?
So I think there's two separate questions there. So on the one hand, in terms of how we think about disaster preparedness, we do have to look at encouraging mitigation of risk wherever possible. One of the proposals we've talked about in a group we're involved with called Smarter Safer, federal disaster assistance is given on a cost share basis with states and local governments. Mm-hmm. We think there should be some incentives in place for states to adopt building codes and appropriate emergency response officials, and that could be worked into the formula so that states that have done so get a greater share from the federal government. States that haven't done so get less of a share from the federal government.
That sounds nice, but what do you actually do about an old bridge that's going to be taken down in a flood, or an old public transit system that goes down entirely? That's big money.
Clearly infrastructure spending is part of this, and we're not opposed to infrastructure spending. We do want to review those sorts of projects closely, because a lot of infrastructure spending that is requested can simply be pork. But where it is appropriate and efficient and effective, it should be directed.
Lori, I come back to that question. You start to multiply this across the country and you wonder if we can keep up with it, as big and strong as our economy is.
Well, I think you have to think about all the things that we do spend our money on. Somehow we manage to afford very expensive wars. We spend a lot of money on different things, and I don't personally see why we can't actually spend money on dealing with these impacts. Yes, there is an opportunity cost. Yes, I completely agree with you, Tom, that it is going to take a very heavy hit on our growth. And that's all the more reason why we have to get very serious and very aggressive about switching over to a different energy system. It's only going to get worse if we don't, right? If you're in a hole, stop digging.
Miami, Florida, Mike is calling. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I've lived through 40 years of Florida hurricanes, and interestingly, we have not been hit in about 8 years now. So the opposite side of your coin may be that while you are buried under snow, we are experiencing fewer hurricanes. So, hurricanes have been a big issue here forever. And one of the main points was perhaps a national catastrophe fund. And I'm wondering what your guests have to say about that.
National Catastrophe Fund. I mean, overall, we've seen, I don't know the exact historical numbers on hurricanes right now, though we've seen intensifying storms and certainly plenty of hurricane damage over time. RJ, it sounds like a National Catastrophe Fund is not the way you want to go. You want to leave communities to sort of face the music on their own so that they take seriously preparation, if I've got you right, RJ.
I would actually say, so no, we do oppose a National Catastrophe Fund, but actually one of the problems of a National Catastrophe Fund is it encourages structures like we have here in Florida, where the state actually is the largest insurer of homes, and the state is also a reinsurer. It's the only state in the country where the state offers reinsurance to property insurers. That forces risk to be concentrated in Florida, as opposed to in the private market. They would be spread out across the globe. Most reinsurers that do business in the United States are actually based elsewhere. There's many in Bermuda. There's many in Europe. There's some big ones in Japan. And the way the reinsurance market works is taking on big risks from all over the globe and spreading them. The National Catastrophe Fund would encourage other states to follow Florida's example, and I think Florida's example is a poor one.
I mean, I say remind you again, Mike, in Miami, this is the Risky Business Project, business folks saying that the annual price tag for coastal damage along the East Coast and the Gulf of Mexico headed for $35 billion. Frank Nutter, I'm reading you in the Times saying it's crucial that industry factor into account the science of climate change and changes to national and global weather patterns in risk assessment and pricing. Do you see industry, business, really beginning to pull this into their financial planning, their business planning, Frank?
Well, certainly the insurance and the reinsurance sector do indeed integrate climate into the risk patterns, but largely they look at the concentration of properties in high-risk areas and look at what the science is saying about the increasing exposure, if you will, a forward-looking approach to assessing risk. And we agree with RJ that it's a bad idea to get the federal government to continue to subsidize insurance rates that, in fact, encourage development in these high-risk areas. I think it's wonderful that Florida hasn't had a major hurricane in 8 years, 9 years. But you can't look at the hurricane patterns in the short term any more than you can look at infrastructure in the short term. You really need to take a long-term point of view that, in fact, would encourage economic development and activity rather than just look at what may happen in the next few years.
Laurie, I've got Greg here writing to us on Facebook. He says, each barrel of oil, each ton of coal should be taxed to fund a sinking fund to defray these costs as we move forward. This has to be a national priority. No state has the financial wherewithal to absorb the impacts measured in billions on its own. How about it, Laurie?
Well, we absolutely have to have some sort of mechanism where we put a price on carbon, and that can be very indirect. It can be basically giving a helping hand to cleaner energy, making sure that we support the president in efforts to reduce our emissions from our strongest, our biggest sources of pollution. Right now, it's our existing power plants. If you do that, you are going to create the incentives for the cleaner energy to just completely come in and dominate the market. And that's sort of an indirect way of putting on this price. Now, right now, the price is so distorted, it's not just these other distortions that our other guests are talking about with flood insurance and that sort of thing. But in the markets itself, the subsidies are high for fossil fuels. So not only do we need to actually put a price on carbon, but also get rid of the subsidies for it and start subsidizing and giving a helping hand to the energies that we know are successful and succeeding and going to be the future.
Well, from Snow Central, where we see the impact of it so deep right outside the windows right now, I want to thank all of you for being with us. Laurie Johnson with the National Resources Defense Council, Frank Nutter with the Reinsurance Association of America, and R.J. Lehman with R Street Institute. Thanks to all of you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.